Welcome to yet another sold-out Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom, and a feast of firsts from the performers, all of whom are making their prom's debuts this evening. Conductor Jaap van Zweden and his orchestra, the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic, and 30-year-old French pianist David Frère. Nothing new minted, though, about the music they're playing. Two pieces that are firmly in their repertoire, in their bones. After the interval, Bruckner's monumental Eighth Symphony. And coming up now, Mozart's 25th Piano Concerto in C Major, a piece that tonight's soloist and conductor have recently recorded together. So let's hear from one of tonight's debutants, pianist David Frère. I asked him, before his rehearsal, how he felt coming into this huge and potentially intimidating auditorium for the very first time.
I just spent maybe half an hour walking around and looking at the hall. It's so beautiful. I have to admit that I was a bit in love with that hall because I knew it from television, from videos, but I never entered into the building. But I have to say that there is something magic in this hall. I can feel that, I think, yes.
And what about this Mozart concerto, a piece you know very well, a piece you've recorded with tonight's conductor, Jaap van Zweden?
Yes, but you know, the more I play it, the more I'm not sure to know it so well. It should be like that for every piece you play. But I think that with Mozart, you have to start from the beginning every time you play a piece. And especially, I have to say that this concerto is maybe more mysterious than another one. The slow movement is very difficult to catch, for example. Also, for the choice of the tempi, it's very difficult. Because the first movement is an allegro maestoso, so it doesn't have to be too fast. The second is an andante, so it doesn't have to be too slow. And the third is an allegretto, not too fast also. It's very, very delicate to feel and to feel this music.
Tonight's pianist, David Frère. Well, the 25th concerto is Mozart's grandest and longest piano concerto, probably composed in 1786. And that key, C major, is a tonality, as Lindsay Kemp says in tonight's programme note, which you can read like all the others at bbc.co.uk/proms, that often drew for the composer a lofty Olympian grandeur. Think, for example, of the Jupiter Symphony for a comparison. But you know, even in the opening moments of this concerto, there's a typically Mozartian trick. The music is martial and imposing, but it's also simultaneously melancholy, reflective. The way the fanfare you hear right at the start quickly melts into a little woodwind tune. Well, by 1786, Mozart was really turning his attention to the opera stage and the Marriage of Figaro. You can hear that in the slow movement, particularly of this concerto. They're coming on stage here now at the Royal Albert Hall, pianist David Frère, conductor Jaap van Zweden, to perform Mozart's 25th Piano Concerto with the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Frère was the soloist in that performance of Mozart's 25th piano concerto here at the Proms. Jaap van Zweden conducted the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra. All three partners there making their Proms debuts in that performance. Something of a forgotten concerto that, between the C minor, number 24, and the 27th in B-flat major, that you may have heard Maria Joao Pires play with the Tonhalle Orchestra of Zurich just a couple of nights ago at the Proms. But what operatic interplay there was between soloist and orchestra in that performance. David Frey taking a solo bow from this packed Royal Albert Hall tonight. There's something operatic too about the physicality of that performance. David Frey, I wonder how you heard it at home, but he was really digging into the instrument. He sits at a what looks like a kind of office chair, so not a conventional piano, still quite low. His elbows are hunched, and he really hunches over the keyboard, seems to dig in right kind of into the innards of the piano. I've got a view from behind him here, behind the first violins. It reminded me of those caricatures of the virtuoso in the 19th century with elbows and arms flailing, and he's got hair a bit like the young Liszt, if you know what the young Liszt looked like. Jaap van Zweden back here, bringing the players of the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra to their feet. One of those pieces that deserves to be heard more often. Well, that's what I think anyway, but let us know what you think. Something else you can do at bbc.co.uk/proms is give us your reviews. Don't wait for all the national newspapers to get their critics out there. Get there first and tell us what you think about David Frey's performance and that concerto. Well, that brings us to interval time at tonight's Prom. And time now to join Ian McMillan for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Welcome to the Royal College of Music in the cultured heart of London for the latest of this year's Proms Plus literary events. Tonight, we're going to be celebrating one of the giants of post-war British prose writing, a Nobel Prize winner who wrote one book that many readers have heard of, but many novels which sadly languish unread until just after tonight's programme, that is. William Golding was born 100 years ago this year, and he's best known for Lord of the Flies, his examination of how our animal natures throb just under our barely civilised surfaces, especially when we're trapped on a desert island. However, his other novels, including Pincher Martin, Freefall, The Spire, and his fantastic sea trilogy, deserve to be brought into the light because, for me, he's a great creator of poetic prose, a marvellous encapsulator of ideas, and a fearless advocate of the epic over the domestic. Joining me to illuminate William Golding's work are his biographer and great literary man, John Carey, and the novelist and Golding aficionado, Meg Rosoff, whose books include How I Live Now and The Bride's Farewell. We'll be hearing extracts from some of Golding's novels, and they're going to be read by Simon Woods. Please welcome my guests. So, John Carey, because he's such an epic writer, it's hard not to be epic when we think about him. But briefly, why should we read him in his centenary year, do you think?
Oh, because of the way he writes. He's a great poetic writer, actually, although it's prose, as you just said. It's always poetry as well, and every time a different kind of poetry. He keeps setting himself in the novels a different problem. Extraordinary. There's no other novelist I know who writes a different novel every time. You know, a lot of novelists write the same novel again and again. I mean, Dickens, in a way. But not Golding. Completely new problems he sets himself. So he writes a novel about schoolboys on a desert island. What will be next? Neanderthal Man. Astounding. And his editor, Charles Monteith at Fabers, wrote about it, wrote a letter saying, you know, how he sat down with the manuscript and thought, what is it now? It's bloody cavemen. You know, schoolboys, then bloody cavemen. And so on. Yeah, he is completely versatile and new every time.
So, Meg, then, do you think it's time to revive his reputation? Because he's not as well known as he should be.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, in a way, I think of him as the great writer's writer, in part because he's a very dark writer. He's very concerned with the darkness inside people, and which, of course, is exactly what writers are interested in, or good writers are always looking for, you know, how to explain the darkness in their own souls. But I think, you know, what John was saying about the creation of worlds, the absolute total creation of a world that is utterly compelling, even though the language is quite sophisticated, quite difficult sometimes. You cannot resist. After two or three pages, you're in that world, you're on that boat, you're on that island.
That's true, it certainly draws you in. We're going to our first extract from Golding's best-known novel, Lord of the Flies, and this is a gloriously poetic description of a body on the shore of the island where the boys found themselves. So the body is a character called Simon. So John, just tell us a little bit about Simon, the person we're about to hear about.
Yeah, right. Simon is different from the other boys. He's an epileptic, but he's also in deeper contact with the serious things that Meg was talking about. And he's intelligent, and he knows that the beast that the boys are afraid of doesn't exist. He's intelligent and brave, and he comes back, having found what it is they're afraid of, to tell them. And they kill him. They're terrified. They think he's a monster and they kill him.
Right. Let's hear it, son.
Along the shoreward edge of the shallows, the advancing clearness was full of strange, moonbeam-bodied creatures with fiery eyes. Here and there, a large pebble clung to its own air and was covered with a coat of pearls. The tide swelled in over the rain-pitted sand and smoothed everything with a layer of silver. Now it touched the first of the stains that seeped from the broken body, and the creatures made a moving patch of light as they gathered at the edge. The water rose further and dressed Simon's coarse hair with brightness. The line of his cheek silvered, and the turn of his shoulder became sculptured marble. The strange attendant creatures, with their fiery eyes and trailing vapors, busied themselves around his head. The body lifted a fraction of an inch from the sand, and a bubble of air escaped from the mouth with a wet plop. Then it turned, gently, in the water. Somewhere over the darkened curve of the world, the sun and moon were pulling, and the film of water on the Earth planet was held, bulging slightly on one side while the solid core turned. The great wave of the tide moved further along the island, and the water lifted. Softly, surrounded by a fringe of inquisitive bright creatures, itself a silver shape beneath the steadfast constellations, Simon's dead body moved out towards the open sea.
It's odd, isn't it? Because, Meg, Golding looked back on his book, on that book, as he called it, boring and crude. And yet it's got this universal appeal, hasn't it? What can we explain the appeal of Lord of the Flies?
I can't, really, in a way. I mean, I find it almost too dark and painful to read. And everybody thinks of it as the novel that is about the dissolution of society. You know, there are these boys on this desert island, and they start out terribly civilized, and then it all goes, you know, to hell, really. But in fact, the darkness and the brutality are there from the very beginning, from when Ralph and Piggy, it is Ralph and Piggy, isn't it, at the beginning, and Piggy says, please, whatever you do, I ask you, you know, you are my friend, whatever you do, don't tell them my name, don't tell them that they called me Piggy at my last school, and, you know, and what does he do immediately? He becomes Piggy, and it's so cringeworthy, it's so painful to read that kind of, you know, casual brutality. I mean, I can't remember who it was, but somebody said that the children's books are the ones that are too dark for adults. And I suppose that perhaps that's why young adults, teenagers, just identify so closely with that, because there's no punches pulled.
John, it's true, though, that this book had a difficult genesis, didn't it? It was rejected by a number of publishers. It almost got rejected by Faber's. It ended up on a pile that Charles Monteith, the editor, took home with him for the weekend. And so it almost didn't happen.
Yeah, that's true. it was rejected by six publishers. But you have to remember that the book that was rejected is not the same as the book that is published and that we have all read. There was a first version in which Simon, the character whose death we've just been hearing about, is actually a sort of mystic figure. He has communion with God. I mean, if a being arrives on the island, invisible but communing with Simon, they do a kind of mystic dance. So it was a very religious book. Golding was at that point in his life extremely religious. He'd been in the Navy, had a terrible war, came out, he was an atheist before, came out, he said he had a religious convulsion. It was a religious book in which the living God appears. Charles Monteith said it must all go. Charles Monteith was an agnostic. He said Simon must be a rational, nothing but what a rational reader will expect, cut out the supernatural stuff. And the letters between Charles and Golding survive in the Faber archive, back and forth, cut this bit, cut. And Golding gave way. He was desperate to be published. He'd written three novels which hadn't been published before. I've read them, all turned down. He was desperate and he gave way. I think eventually he regretted it. But what happens is a novel in which God is something, in which religion is something made up by terrified boys on an island. And it had got the living God in it as he wrote it.
So in those early novels, the version of Lord of the Flies that got rejected, can we see the poetry in the prose? Was that there all the
absolutely.
Way through?
Absolutely, yeah. That is absolutely true. And I went through the original manuscript survives, and I've been through it very carefully. For example, that passage that Simon just read is almost word for word in the first version, almost word for word. One or two bits he improves, but it's, yeah. All the great passages are there. All that happened was that Charles cut bits. No, he didn't add bits, he cut bits.
So all the way through his career, until Monteith was a very elderly man, him and Golding had a very interesting relationship, a very good editor-writer relationship.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. I mean, Charles understood him so well. Golding was extremely diffident, extremely nervous, hated writing, was terrified of critics. So to get him to write at all was very difficult. And when he sent The Inheritors to Charles, it was full of sort of apologies. It was only a first draft, just because it's no good and so on. And Charles said, publish it as it is, you know. Golding was terrified and said, well, shouldn't we go and consult an anthropologist? And I've just made it up, really. Charles said, no, an anthropologist, any suggestions they would have would be the wrong kind of suggestion, which was just the right advice. But, you know, he coaxed him along over the doubts and fears and corrected what he thought had to be corrected. He was a perfect editor. And there are hundreds of letters between them in the Golding archive in Faber's.
All right, let's hear an extract from The Inheritors, which is Golding's astonishing imagining of a Neanderthal world. In this extract, Loke, the Neanderthal, encounters a Homo sapien man for the first time. Simon.
The man turned sideways in the bushes and looked at Loke along his shoulder. A stick rose upright, and there was a lump of bone in the middle. Loke peered at the stick and the lump of bone and the small eyes in the bone things over the face. Suddenly, Loke understood that the man was holding the stick out to him, but neither he nor Loke could reach across the river. He would have laughed if it were not for the echo of the screaming in his head. The stick began to grow shorter at both ends. Then it shot out to full length again. The dead tree, by Loke's ear, acquired a voice. Clop. His ears twitched, and he turned to the tree. By his face, there had grown a twig. A twig that smelt of other, and of goose, and of the bitter berries that Loke's stomach told him he must not eat. This twig had a white bone at the end. There were hooks in the bone, and sticky brown stuff hung in the crooks. His nose examined this stuff and did not like it. He smelt along the shaft of the twig. The leaves on the twig were red feathers and reminded him of goose. He was lost in a generalized astonishment and excitement.
John, that's a description of a bow and arrow, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
It just reminds me so much of Craig Raine, of the Martian school of writing. A Martian sends a postcard home, the idea of looking at something familiar from a very unfamiliar point of view. So it seems that he was a kind of pre-Martian Martian.
Absolutely. I think Craig acknowledges that. And Golding, in a book not published called Men, Women and Now, where he talks about standing as if you were a Martian watching women, men and women in the street, uses the term Martian, actually, yeah.
So, Meg, I know that Golding had been fascinated by archaeology since his school days, but this is a fantastic feat of imagination. An amazing use of language to evoke Neanderthal consciousness. And again, it goes back to the poetry, I think, the poetry of the language.
It is poetic, but, I mean, sometimes poetry these days, you know, in writing, is sort of associated with that kind of school of creative writing, mm-hmm. which I often think is overwriting. The thing that always strikes me about Golding is that it's very bare, it's very sparse. I mean, the words are beautiful, the writing is beautiful, but you never feel overloaded by metaphor. What you do feel in every sentence that he writes is the voice under it, you know, the passion. I mean, he's writing about very, you know, dark and disturbing subjects, but he does seem to care about humanity, and it is as if you're reading his struggle to understand what goes wrong.
Seems to me as well that he wasn't at that time writing like anybody else in English anyway. And I remember at that time in the 60s and 70s, people were almost talking about the death of the novel in some ways. And he kind of reinvented it, but was also seen sometimes, John, wasn't he, as a science fiction writer?
Yeah, that's quite right. He was a friend of Brian Aldiss, and I've talked to Brian about him, and Brian says, yes, that he read science fiction. Charles sent him science fiction books, read science fiction magazines. And, of course, you can see in a way why, because all the books, all the first three books anyway, are science fiction in that you set yourself a problem, what would happen if, as a science fiction writer would. He was a great fan of H.G. Wells, and I keep finding Wells in his writing. Stories from Wells that he's turned his way. So yeah, I think what Meg says about the depth of the soul is absolutely right, but also there's a questing imagination. What would happen if you're on a boat going to Australia in the early 19th century? You know, what would happen? And relating it to how we have turned out to be, because the Neanderthals, Golding thinks, were pre-fall. He was interested in the fall of man, and once talking to an audience of students, he said the Neanderthals are not fallen because they can't think. They can imagine, but they can't think. He said the fall is thought.
Gosh. Let's hear the third extract now from The Spire, which is a novel of spirituality, guilt, and an examination of the creative act. In this passage, Dean Jocelyn climbs the spire he's having built on top of Salisbury Cathedral and surveys the landscape below. Son.
His joy beat at him like wings. I would like the spire to be 1,000 feet high, he thought, and then I should be able to oversee the whole county. And he wondered at himself, remembering whose spire it would be. And as if in answer, he thought he felt his angel at his back, warming him in the wind. Now it is true, without any doubt, up here among the tapping and clinking and scraping, here, moving towards the clouds, I am cheerful as a child that sings. I didn't know I could still be as happy. So he stood on the planks in the wind and let the happiness calm all the confusions in his head. He examined the strips and patches of cultivation, the rounded downlands that rose to a wooded and notched edge. They were soft and warm and smooth as a young body. He got down on his knees, hard, eyes shut, crossing himself and praying. I bring my essential wickedness even here into thy air, for the world is not like that. The earth is a huddle of noseless men grinning upward. There are gallows everywhere. The blood of childbirth never ceases to flow, nor sweat in the furrow. The brothels are down there, and drunk men lie in the gutter. There is no good thing in all this circle but the great house, the ark, the refuge, a ship to contain all these people, and now fitted with a mast. Forgive me.
There's such a great biblical cadence to that paragraph, isn't there, where he goes, there's no good thing in all this circle, but the great house, the ark, the refuge, a ship to contain all these people, and now fitted with a mast. Why is he saying forgive me there? What?
Well, I mean, it's a biblical cadence and it's a biblical theme. When you said previously, you know, what is the subject he always writes about? The answer really is sin, and that's a very good example of it. I mean, there is Jocelyn joying in life and suddenly realizes, no, it isn't, it's dreadful, we're sinful. And that is how God must see it. So the complete switch of viewpoint in the middle of it, that is very Golding-esque, I think, and it's very biblical.
And Meg, in books like The Spire and Fire Down Below, there are these dark, brooding sexual themes there in human nature, just bubbling there under the surface. But there's also this overriding theme of redemption or not, redemption or the lack of it. Do you get a sense of redemption within?
I don't get an awful lot of redemption in Golding, which doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that there was no affection for humanity or no interest in it, or, you know, it wasn't black and white. I mean, not a lot of overt warmth, but a lot of understanding in his writing, and a lot of attempt to really get to the bottom of what human nature is about.
I think at the end that's why I read him, because I am, although the themes are dark, I'm uplifted by the prose, I'm uplifted by the cadences and the language and the images.
And the honesty, yes. You know, a really honest writer is uplifting. The themes don't have to be cheerful. Mm.
So John, finally then, what's his legacy? What does he leave for us now in 2011?
Oh, he leaves what he'd always given, I think. He makes you think seriously. He's the most serious novelist, consistently serious novelist, I know. And not in a way that is tedious. I mean, it's excitingly serious, because every time it's new. So his legacy is thought, I think. The thing he said that made us fallen, but it's thought.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks very much to John Carey, Meg Rosoff and Simon Woods, and to you, the audience. And now let's all go and form a queue at the G section of our library or bookshop, because the William Golding Centenary Revival begins here.
Ian McMillan presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Eliane Glazer. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's Prom. Just one work on the programme, but what a work it is. Bruckner's Eighth Symphony, composed originally in 1887, revised two or three years later, and only first performed in Vienna in 1892. Now, tonight's conductor, Jaap van Zweden, was the leader of the Concertgebouw Orchestra in Amsterdam for 17 years, which meant that he played this symphony with conductors like Eugen Jochum and Bernard Haitink. So it's music he knows inside out from both sides of the podium. But it's a piece whose gigantic journey he's still discovering, as he told me earlier.
The piece has so many colors and has so many treasures that every time, even in a week like this week, you wake up, you start to rehearse, and you discover again something which you did not know, or which you just did not see and hear. And then it's like a hidden treasury. So the piece is a journey on itself, but the wonderful thing is that it is every day new. And what I particularly love about Bruckner is that, and I don't like to compare composers, but if you set them next to each other, Mahler and Bruckner, then for me, Mahler is always taking you in a roller coaster of emotions, and Bruckner is just talking about beauty. And for me, it's a little step higher in a way. It's a little bit closer to heaven.
Tonight's conductor, Jaap van Zweden. Well, music that's close to heaven, maybe. But before we get there, there's real darkness in this symphony too, from the way it opens in a sepulchral minor key to the huge dissonance at the heart of the first movement, or the opening of the finale, the final fourth movement, a whipped-up march that's like a frenzied horse ride, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, perhaps, to continue Yarp's idea, heralds of the heavenly major key coda in which the symphony ends, in which Bruckner brings back tunes from all four movements, the opening Allegro Moderato, the second Scherzo movement, which may or may not be inspired by Bruckner's love of steam trains, the extraordinary, radiant, timeless Adagio, and the finale itself, marked feierlich, nicht schnell, solemn, not fast. So here comes Jaap van Zweden to conduct the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra in Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. Bruckner's 8th Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. Jaap van Zweden conducted the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra. Jaap van Zweden was saying to me just before the rehearsal that a good hall demands Bruckner, a hall like the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, he said, or like the Royal Albert Hall here, and surely this space was made for that music, made for music like the final 5 minutes, especially of Bruckner's 8th Symphony. Jaap van Zweden bringing the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic's principal horn to her feet, Petra Bokma, and the whole horn section, four of them playing horns, four of them playing Wagner tubas at the end of Bruckner's 8th Symphony. The principal trumpet, Hessel Boomer, and indeed the trombone, Herman Naas. All of those soloists really in that gigantic brass section. Eight horns, four trumpets, three trombones, tuba, triple woodwind, three harps, and a huge complement of strings. Jaap van Zweden brings the rest of his orchestra, the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic, to their feet. And the orchestra, he and the orchestra embarked on a recorded cycle of Bruckner's symphonies. Installments still to come, though, including this one, the 8th. Looking forward to that a lot, I have to say. So extraordinary, that music that Bruckner writes at the end of that symphony, when the themes that we've been listening to for the last 80 minutes come together in one contrapuntal single texture. It's as if you can experience the whole symphony in one point. Time seems to both expand and to stand still. Jaap van Zweden comes on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. It's an increasingly tumultuous reception he's getting from the orchestra and the Royal Albert Hall here, the full Royal Albert Hall. Well, more proms to enjoy tomorrow. A world premiere from Graham Fitkin, a cello concerto that Yo-Yo Ma will play. BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by David Roberts. And then in the second half, the annual appearance of Beethoven's 9th Symphony. All that to come. And a proms portrait, a composer portrait that I'll be doing with Graham Fitkin that you can hear after tomorrow's prom. But now, though, with the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic on their feet, quite a lot of the Royal Albert Hall too, even the audience in the arena too. Time to hand you back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
And that was Tom Service presenting tonight's prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. You can hear it again online, of course, for the next 7 days, or again here on BBC Radio 3 on Thursday afternoon at 2:30.
She made her BBC Proms debut a decade ago. Now she returns to London's Royal Albert Hall to play the same work in 2011. Pianist Hélène Grimaud plays Beethoven's evergreen 4th piano concerto in the first of a pair of concerts by the Pittsburgh Symphony and its current music director, Manfred Honeck. I'm Susie Klein. Join me this Monday night at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, our next programme this evening on Radio 3 is our feature, Robert Schumann and the Music of the Future. And that's just under half an hour away at 10:15. So, in the meantime, let's stay in a sound world that Bruckner would have been familiar with, music for organ. This is something with a difference, music for violin and organ. Six pieces, Opus 150, by Josef Rheinberger. Christopher Herrick as the organist, Paul Barrett the violinist.
Thank you.